This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Chris Horner. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington. We want to get his reaction to the long-awaited Senate version of cap-and-trade legislation unveiled here on Wednesday. For the most part, it seems pretty similar to House legislation, but is actually even more stringent on carbon emission reductions to be accomplished over the next decade or so. And Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
Well, obviously, you're a strong opponent of what was passed in the House earlier this year, back in June. How different is this bill in the Senate from what we saw in the House?
Materially, it's different in very few ways. The first is that in the first few years, it's actually more expensive, more stringent. That is, it requires more be done by the year 2020. You've heard cost estimates about the House bill, and they always say in the year 2020, and they say that because that's the year before things really kick in. The Senate version, as drafted, goes a little further, but they end up in the same place, and that's by the year 2050, 83% energy use reduction, and barring some technological breakthroughs that are unforeseen. It also is missing certain key specifics. That is, it's much shorter. The House bill ended up to be 1,300 pages. This is about 800 right now. The difference is they don't tell the regulated world how these, what they're calling energy use allowances or ration coupons, are divvied up. And the reason, to be cynical for a moment, but having seen how the House process unfolded, the reason is because the bidding is essentially open for groups to come and support this early. They make out better in the Senate version. That's how the House bill arrived at what would otherwise appear to be fairly arbitrary assignment of who gets what percentage of these energy use allowances, which are given out for free for the first decade. And then, like I said, at 2020, the pain really starts. So between that, there's only one key difference, and that is the legislation is being touted as saying you'd much rather have Congress write a bill than have EPA come at you willy-nilly. The House, at least, took away for 6 years EPA's ability to come at you willy-nilly in addition to legislation. The Senate leaves them unleashed. In other words, the idea that you can take legislation in return for certainty is a myth. This is the worst of both worlds. It's a double whammy. It's Congress and EPA doing its will.
Chris, let's talk about a couple of different things that you mentioned. First of all, the massive energy reduction, or at least energy output reduction, certainly by 2050, but even by 2020, according to both pieces of legislation. How is that supposed to be accomplished exactly? You mentioned the credits and how those are still yet to be officially divvied out and so forth. But ultimately, in the real world, how's that going to work?
Well, in Europe, it is worked out by people leaving. If you're in an energy-intensive industry, and particularly a capital-intensive industry like steel manufacturing, where to invest in a new facility would cost hundreds of millions of dollars, you just don't bother. You leave them with old equipment, and you move your growth to other places, like, for example, Carroll County, Kentucky, where we have 175 European steel jobs being occupied by Americans at North American Stainless Steel, a Spanish company. That's typically what would happen, because as President Obama said, the goal of cap and trade is to cause electricity prices to, quote, necessarily skyrocket, his words, not mine, and to, quote, bankrupt certain facilities, again, his word, not mine. So you would leave in the real world. The idea behind this is if you have great faith in the state, if no faith in markets, you essentially say, you're greedy, you'll figure it out. If I put some extremely difficult mandate upon you, I'm sure you'd like to stay in business and keep making money, so you'll figure it out. You will force technology that we do not foresee, that otherwise doesn't exist, to essentially replace our principal sources of energy, which are called hydrocarbons or fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, with pixie dust. And so it's to force technology. That's been the way environmental laws have been written. So far, they cost, according to the Treasury, 1% of our gross domestic product. Because you can't, you know, the laws of physics remain undefeated. You can't force things that can't be forced, and we don't seem to be around the corner from an energy breakthrough. So you're going to try to force technology, but in practice you're going to export jobs, as, by the way, some internal administration documents we received at the Competitive Enterprise Institute under the Freedom of Information Act show the administration knows full well.
Chris, when they talk about renewable energies, usually the discussion is around wind and solar. Are there any other technologies that they're embracing? And even if you put them all together, how much would that offset the loss of what we normally rely on?
Well, we get about 20% of our electricity from nuclear, about 20% of our electricity from gas, about 50% from coal, and 10% from the rest, but most of that rest is hydropower dams. So you're talking about if you doubled wind and solar, you'd go from about 1% to 2%. You're not talking about displacing a whole lot, and yet that whole lot is essentially regulated out of existence within a decade under this law. So you can pile up wind, solar, biomass, even hydroelectric, but again, we're breaking dams in this country. We're not building new ones. That's not environmentally correct anymore. So you're talking about hoping for a breakthrough. Like I said, you put a particularly onerous mandate on people who need energy to exist, and you hope that they will somehow find a way to make it happen. But again, as I pointed out, in the real world, that has meant leaving, because you won't replace 50% of our electricity with windmills anytime soon, or solar, or biomass, or hydrogen, or anything else breakthrough that we don't foresee.
What about on the jobs front? Obviously, for those who work with coal and natural gas and regular petroleum, there's a lot of refining and other work, transporting and so forth that needs to be done. Not a lot of jobs needed to make the wind blow or the sun to shine. So where are all these green jobs going to come from?
Well, again, that's a mythology, as academic studies from Europe have found, both in Spain and Denmark, because the president said, look at what's happening in countries like Spain and Denmark. So they set about to look at what happened. And it turns out you will chase away, as I pointed out, steel jobs from Spain to America. And the argument was, but we need steel to make windmills. If we mandate windmills, why, we will still have a steel industry. That's not how it's working out. Most of the so-called green jobs are in installation, so they're a bubble. In other words, once they're installed, your 60-day installation contract disappeared, and you traded a permanent steel job in return for that. So you need to keep pumping more and more taxpayer money into this bubble. And what we've seen is the green jobs actually can be exported. Those that aren't installation, meaning if to make the big turbines for the windmills, the European companies have been leaving this year for China and India and other places where they haven't imposed the very same mandates that make electricity too expensive to make the parts there, the same mandates that actually create an industry for these groups. So it's more of this interventionist theory that may look good on paper except upon scrutiny, but in practice has been an absolute disaster, and something we truly need to do what the president said. Look what's happening in these countries. Don't just think about a Spanish windmill myth. Look at the reality, and the reality is it's been a disaster, as the Spanish government recognized in an April 30th royal decree. So the facts are on our side, and strongly against doing something like this to America's economy.
We're talking with Chris Horner, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Chris, you know, with those in favor of this legislation say, well, the critics are out there criticizing, but where's their plan? Republicans, of course, for the past year or so have gone with the all of the above mantra, nuclear, continue to do the oil, natural gas, expand offshore drilling, get it out of shale, expand nuclear power in addition to exploring renewable technologies. What's your approach? What would be the smartest energy reform policy?
Well, all of the above makes sense, because if you realize the green jobs and the global warming agenda is premised upon the argument of catastrophic man-made global warming being here and accelerating, except it's been cooling for a decade, and the cooling is projected to continue for several more decades. So the premise on its face has failed. But let's even assume their premise. Nobody says anything ever proposed. Nothing, not the Senate bill, not the House bill, not the Kyoto Protocol, nothing ever proposed would, according to anyone, under any scenario or set of assumptions, have a detectable impact on the climate. That's not debatable. The argument is, well, Kyoto's the first of 30 treaties. Well, the first one's been a bit of a disaster. Let's look at it realistically. The growth in emissions is not in the United States or Europe. It's in China, India, Mexico, Brazil, South Korea, Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on, countries that say they will never adopt such schemes. So you're talking about all pain, no gain if you follow this prescription. What you need to do then is provide more affordable, abundant, reliable electricity, because the fact is, if I'm wrong and you go with me, you're going to be richer to deal with what we always face. That is severe, always unpredictable, often severe weather. If they're wrong and you go with them, you have left the world poorer to deal with what we're always going to have to face. And if they're right, well, you've left the world poorer to deal with what they say is catastrophic climate change. And that's, energy poverty is not the answer, no matter what the question, unless it's what is precisely the wrong thing to do, and that's pursue an energy poverty agenda. Just real quickly, Greg, I mean, the point of a green job, if you had to define it, and nobody has so far, is something that requires more more man-hours to produce a kilowatt-hour of electricity, which means, taking to its logical conclusion, you could require we get 20% of our electricity from running on giant hamster wheels. You would create jobs in the giant hamster wheel industry, but you have to think of the unseen. You would kill many, many more jobs. There's great economic cost here and no alleged climatic benefit.
Last question, Chris. What do you expect to happen at the end of all this?
Oh, I think, as with certain other issues, you're going to see something passed, because there is so much political capital or face invested in it. It won't be as it won't be cap and trade. It won't be a more transparent, less costly carbon or energy tax. It will be more pork toward these industries that can't make it on their own, these green jobs industries, and we will wave it around saying, look at us, we did something. The treaty idea will ultimately fall by the wayside, because the vast majority of the world continues to say no, and that's just on its face unworkable.
Chris, unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you very much, as always, for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Chris Horner, Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.